Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present New York City-based journalist Ari Paul, who assesses the coming battle over nominating a replacement for the late conservative Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Organizer Megan Halloran, who discusses how she rallied supporters to prevent trees on her Pennsylvania property from being cut down to make way for a controversial gas pipeline. And Paul Kavika Martin of Peace Action, who explains why his group opposes the Obama administration and Pentagon plan to spend over $1 trillion to modernize the U.S. nuclear weapons arsenal. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The European Commission is crafting legislation to force U.S. tech giants like Google and Amazon to publicly disclose their European earnings and secret tax deals made with governments. According to the Guardian newspaper, Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker, a former Prime Minister of Luxembourg, reportedly favors the new tax disclosure rules, which would apply only to large multinational corporations operating within the European Union. 2 years ago, corporate tax avoidance strategies outraged Europeans after the so-called LuxLeaks revelations that exposed how big corporations like Pepsi, IKEA, and FedEx won sweetheart tax deals in Luxembourg. The EU's Competition Commissioner, Margrethe Vestager, ruled that Starbucks in the Netherlands and Fiat in Luxembourg engaged in excessive tax avoidance and were fined 30 million euros each in unpaid taxes. Similar investigations on tax avoidance are ongoing against Apple and Amazon. Tove Maria Reiding of the European Network on Debt and Development says the EU initiative does not go far enough in limiting public disclosure to corporations with European sales over 750 million euros a year, excluding the vast majority of multinationals. Members of the nearly 1.5 million Arabs living in Israel, a fifth of the country's overall population, find themselves wrestling with the seemingly contradictory evolution of integrating into Israel's middle class while deepening their identification with the Palestinian people. Nowhere are they fully at home. In Israel, many Jews view them as a fifth column, and in the Arab world, they are seen as collaborators with Israel. Today, their identity crisis is especially acute. They have made rapid strides in education, professional advancement, and political representation. Many are fluent in Hebrew and value the country's Western orientation. An Arab party is the third largest in the Knesset, Israel's parliament. However, half of Israel's Arab population remains impoverished, and yawning social gaps persist with Jews. The Christian Science Monitor reports that the stalemate in negotiations on a Palestinian state, coupled with recurring cycles of war and uprising in Gaza and the West Bank, and most recently Jerusalem, has made many Arab Israelis uncomfortable speaking Arabic or wearing traditional dress in Jewish areas. The January 1st killing of two Israelis in a Tel Aviv bar by an Arab citizen prompted Israel's right-wing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to accuse the minority of being a state within a state, seen by many as an echo of his much-criticized Election Day get-out-the-vote warning to followers that Arabs were streaming to the ballot box. In her State of the State address, New Mexico's Republican Governor Suzanne Martinez advocated a tough-on-crime agenda in response to growing violence in the southwestern state. The move comes after other conservative states like Georgia and Utah have embraced criminal justice reforms that include allocating more resources to parole supervision and improving inmate access to drug and mental health treatment. Martinez and key Republican legislators support a new three strikes law where repeat violent offenders will be eligible to receive life sentences, new restrictions on bail, and stiffer penalties for repeat drunk driving violations. New Mexico has been ranked as the second most dangerous state in America. It currently has the highest rate per capita of violent assaults of any state in the country. Currently, 22% of New Mexico's residents live below the poverty level, and Albuquerque, the state's largest city, has a crime rate twice the national average. Norman Reamer of the National Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys says that New Mexico's government is overreacting to recent high-profile cases, including the murder of two police officers. Reamer argued, there is hard data that proves When you over-prosecute and over-incarcerate, you actually promote more crime and increase recidivism. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
With the death of the Supreme Court's longest-serving justice, Antonin Scalia, on February 13th, new political battle lines were drawn over the fight to replace him. Just hours after the rigidly conservative justice's demise, Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell asserted that the nomination of a replacement should wait until after the November 2016 presidential election, an opinion shared by many other GOP senators and presidential candidates. But President Obama has pledged to fulfill his constitutional duty by nominating a successor in due time. Scalia, appointed by President Ronald Reagan in 1986, was the court's most influential conservative member. He promoted an originalist interpretation of the U.S. Constitution, opposing the more progressive approach of contemporary ratification, where each generation must interpret the Constitution according to changes in society. During oral arguments in a pivotal affirmative action case in December 2015, Justice Scalia suggested that African American students might belong at less rigorous schools than their white counterparts. In overturning a key section of the Voting Rights Act in 2013, Scalia said the legislation was a perpetuation of racial entitlement. The late justice was also well known for his controversial anti-gay and lesbian views. Your reporter spoke with New York City-based journalist Ari Paul, who has covered politics for The Nation, Vice, The Guardian, Dissent, Jacobin, and many other publications. Here he assesses Scalia's conservative legacy and the coming battle over nominating a replacement. He begins by reviewing some of the important cases now pending before the High Court that will be affected by Scalia's death.
One of the biggest ones, of course, is the recently argued Fredericks versus CTA, which is a case that would have very much affected all public sector unions in the United States. The case would have imposed a right-to-work regime over all public sector unions. That would mean that anyone who does not want to join the union in a certain workplace that is unionized would not have to pay dues. Those people who don't want to join a union have to pay what's called an agency shop fee that covers the collective bargaining rights and all the benefits that they get along with union representation. This would sort of allow people to opt out in a workplace that would very much cripple a lot of public sector unions, especially teacher unions, because the members' dues money is how these unions operate. So if they lose even 20-30% of their membership dues, this very much means layoffs. It's very difficult for them to operate. This was argued in January. It had unionists extremely nervous because they knew that it would be a close vote. But at the hearings, it was very clear to everybody that all five conservative justices were buying the anti-union argument being presented there, and most unions were preparing for a new right-to-work regime coming in June. Now, with the death of Scalia, that leaves everything at about a 4-4. And this kicks the case back down to the original Ninth Circuit decision, which upheld the current union dues regime. Now, that kind of gives labor a reprieve for a while. It's not exactly a victory. This would mean that either the case would have to be heard before the full court in the next term, so this could kick the can to possibly 2017, or the more likely situation is that the anti-union organizations that have backed these right-to-work lawsuits will simply find another test case and present it, and they'll have another chance. Now, we don't know who's going to replace Scalia, so that totally, you know, remakes the landscape, but it's definitely a reprieve for labor. And on a number of other issues, especially the case out of Texas with affirmative action, there was a fear that among some people that there would be a 5-4 decision striking down the ability to use any kind of race-based affirmative action in admissions in higher education. That's also thrown to the wind. So there's a lot of cases, but those are sort of the big ones that have been cited in the news.
One of the cases that I've been reading about is the redistricting case where conservative forces are trying to contend that only voters should be counted in congressional districts when it comes to designing and mapping out
new congressional district maps. And, of course, that would negate counting underage citizens, non-citizens, and others who don't have the right to vote, prisoners as well, of course. What's the import of that case, do you think?
Well, you know, this really is a part of the almost sort of half-century-long battle that the political right has waged through the judicial realm to undo a lot of the progress of the 1960s and 1970s. If you read Jeffrey Toobin's book about called The Nine about the Supreme Court, it actually lays it out fairly well. And Scalia was very much part of this sort of multi-decade-long movement to undo a lot of the legal progress, and part of that is the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. So he was very much a part of these cases that, you know, would have the court say, well, these things were necessary in a time of social upheaval, in a time of transition, but they don't fit for 2016. We've made a lot of progress since then. It's time to undo these things. And of course, people on the civil rights end of things would argue, you know, the opposite, that of course it's not 50 years ago, but there are new problems and new issues and things need to have oversight. So that's very much something that's going to be a key talking point as the question of who replaces Scalia goes forward, because that really is what's at stake for the right now. They've enjoyed a 5-4 kind of block to advance these things ever since the George W. Bush administration, when O'Connor, who is considered more of a centrist, left. So this really throws their project into the gears.
And maybe you could explore one other comment, and that was a comment made by Justice Scalia in another case where he's talking about how blacks in this country would not benefit from placement in prestigious universities, but would be better placed in slower track institutions. Another example of what I think can only be classified as blatant racism.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when he died, there was sort of a feeling amongst a lot of people of, oh, was he even that old? Was he ill? I haven't seen the man's medical record, but it's quite possible that this was a man, you know, towards the end of his life where he sort of felt, I can just about say anything I want at this point. You know, who's going to stop me? I mean, they enjoy a great degree of freedom to say exactly what's on their mind. But as you say, it does sort of really show the dark heart of that part of the conservative movement, that this was their hero, this was their activist judge, and that he was so willing to, you know, basically say something that, you know, the average person interprets as, you know, blatantly racist.
That was New York City-based journalist Ari Paul. For more perspectives on Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia's conservative record and the battle ahead to replace him, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A family in rural New Milford Township in northeast Pennsylvania is taking a stand against the plan to build a gas pipeline that would destroy their maple trees, from which they get sap for their small commercial maple syrup operation. The 124-mile Constitution Pipeline is one of many gas pipelines being proposed or constructed throughout the eastern U.S. to transport fracked gas from the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania and other states. Partners in the project include Williams, a leading energy infrastructure company, and Cabot Oil and Gas, Piedmont Natural Gas, and WGL Holdings. According to the Constitution.com website, the 30-inch diameter pipeline will move enough gas to power 3 million homes. Owners of the pipeline say the gas is going to New England states, but many climate activists and a growing number of state elected officials say the new pipeline is not necessary, and the nation instead should be moving to develop 100% renewable energy sources. Critics say there is growing evidence that the gas moved through the pipeline would be exported to Canada or used to fire up new gas-powered electric plants in the region. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Megan Holleran, whose family called on local and regional supporters to stand with them starting on January 30th, to keep out-of-state work crews from destroying their trees. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, granted the pipeline construction company permission last month to cut down the trees. Holleran describes the confrontation that occurred on February 10th when supporters succeeded in defending the property. She says family members and supporters plan to stay on site until March 31st, the deadline by which the company must complete tree cutting before federal restrictions kick in, protecting birds and bats until work can resume on November 1st. The Williams Company filed a request on February 15th, seeking a court order authorizing state police to remove protesters from the site.
They've been in the works with this pipeline for about 5 years now, 4 or 5 years now, where they began approaching landowners for easement agreements. My family, who owns this property, we own a 23-acre property here in New Milford, including fields and forest and a home and our lake. And they approached us to put an easement through about 5 acres of that. We said no, that should have been enough. Unfortunately, it wasn't. And after a couple of years of legal conflict and continue to say no, they seized the property by eminent domain, and they are now planning to come through and begin clearing trees in the Pennsylvania portion of line and on our property.
Talk a little bit about eminent domain and how it's used and how it can be used by a private company for private gain, taking over another private entity's property, like your family.
The way that the eminent domain works in this case is that because the pipeline is regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, they have the power to grant them a certificate of public convenience and necessity, which gives them public utility status, you know, which then gives them the power to use eminent domain. And the idea being that there's a couple of conditions for eminent domain. One is that a project which is supposed to serve the public good, specifically it is supposed to serve the good of the people that are being impacted by the project. They also are required to consider all available alternate routes before they choose to use a property for eminent domain. This is why it's mostly used for things like roads that everyone drives on and that have some pretty logical restrictions on where they can and can't put a road. In this case, the pipeline says they have met those conditions because they claim to be transporting gas to New England and say that the public good will be getting natural gas to New England. Even though the landowners impacted by this are in New York and Pennsylvania, and will not receive any benefit from the pipeline. And they also didn't consider all their viable routes in these cases. But because they're considered to be a public utility, they're allowed to seize our land to make a profit, basically.
So you've had people all around making sure that the company doesn't come on, the trucks and the tree cutters. What happened Wednesday morning? I guess that was February 10th?
So Wednesday morning around 9:30, about 6 pickup trucks pulled in, probably about 15 to 20 personnel. We've met them multiple times at this point. And they also had two Williams representatives with them who I had not met before, who chose to wait until 10 minutes into our conversation to introduce themselves. And then they informed me that they plan to clear trees here on the property. I told them that we plan to try to stop them, you know, without any specifics as to how, but, you know, just so we did not intend to allow them to do that. And I explained my position to them on why I thought that they shouldn't be clearing trees. Our argument here is that we don't know that this pipeline's going to get built, and we certainly don't know that the trees need to be cut right now. They can't cut trees in New York State right now. FERC has only given Williams a partial notice to proceed in Pennsylvania only, so they can only cut trees in Pennsylvania. New York State hasn't given all the permitting that would even allow for construction of the pipeline. If that doesn't go through, if those permits get denied, the pipeline won't be built at all. It is one project, even though it's interstate. So without construction in New York, they can't build it in Pennsylvania. It'll be a whole different project. They do have some deadlines that we don't think they're going to be able to meet. We have some legal issues still being worked out. There's 2 appeals that have been filed. There's an injunction that's been filed. There's a motion to stay that's been filed with the FERC. Some very legitimate legal issues that are pending that, you know, haven't been denied yet. And so if any of those go through, they could potentially stop the tree cutting and revoke the right of the pipeline to begin doing that, of Williams to begin that tree cutting. And so we were asking Williams to not cut trees here. It's a little premature. You can't put them back on once you've taken them down, you know. And the police did come. It was 3 plainclothes officers, unmarked car. They were very low key. They were very laid back. Nobody came in guns blazing. They spoke with the Williams representative without us present for about 10 minutes or so. And then they came and spoke with me without the Williams representatives present for a while. And I explained the whole situation to them again and told them, you know, what we were doing here and our reasons for why we think that they shouldn't start cutting trees. They understood, they listened, and they said that they did not plan to take any action, and they did not plan to enforce anything. And so they said they were going to tell that to the Williams representative. They went and they spoke to him again. And then a few minutes later, I talked to him, and he said they were going to leave. Packed up their chainsaws. Most of the crew had been present for our conversations, and they packed their things up, and they went somewhere else. Yeah, it was a pretty successful interaction. You know, we asked them to leave and they did.
That was Pennsylvania organizer and activist Megan Halloran. For more information on opposition to the proposed Constitution pipeline, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Obama administration plans to spend $3.4 billion to increase the deployment of heavy weapons, armored vehicles, and other equipment to NATO countries in Central and Eastern Europe, with the goal of countering what U.S. officials say is a newly aggressive Russia under Vladimir Putin's leadership. They point to Moscow's 2014 annexation of Crimea and the country's support for separatist rebels in eastern Ukraine. The budget request is four times the current budget of $789 million, representing the largest military buildup in Europe since the end of the Cold War. In response, Russian officials say NATO's move is a threat to European stability. To underscore that point, the Russian military was put on high alert in mid-February and held snap war games in central and southern Russia near Ukraine. In another echo of the Cold War era, President Obama announced plans in 2013 to modernize the U.S. nuclear arsenal over the next three decades at a cost of nearly $1 trillion. The plan calls for updating America's nuclear triad, which includes intercontinental ballistic missiles, as well as submarines and aircraft capable of delivering nuclear warheads. There is growing concern that moves now underway to upgrade and deploy new weapon systems by both the U.S. and Russia will trigger a new Cold War with dangerous and unintended consequences. Your reporter spoke with Paul Kavika Martin, political and communications director with the group Peace Action. Here he discusses the ratcheting up of tensions in Eastern Europe and explains why his group opposes President Obama's plan to modernize the U.S. nuclear weapons arsenal.
Yeah, I think you'd easily argue that we are in a new Cold War because not only are we increasing in our spendings on nuclear weapons and conventional weapons that surround Russia. But Russia has also been increasing its military budget. And then the interesting thing is now this is nearly now a three-person Cold War because China has also been increasing its military budget.
What do you think the danger is here in the escalation along the Russian-European border? What is your largest concern here about the weaponry that's going to be going into this region?
Yes, the $3.4 billion we're increasing. That's a four times increase, so four times what we spent last year. Is going to go first into troops. So we already have 62,000 troops in some 12 European countries, and we're going to increase that by 10 to 15,000 troops. We're going to be giving more money to NATO, spending more money for training, and then probably the most concern is putting more combat vehicles along the Russian border. And this is already has a reaction from Russia, in which they are now putting more vehicles and things on its border. So my biggest concern, obviously, would be some skirmish that would happen or something small and someone makes a mistake, start like a little mini war there. And then just in the larger concerns about, is this really how we want to be spending our monies? And if you look at our Pentagon spending, we are spending over 50% of our discretionary budget in the U.S. is going to the Pentagon. Now, when you're at home and you're making your own budget, you probably don't spend 50% of it on fences and alarms and security for your family. It's just not the way we normally spend things. And so when we have limited dollars to spend on other things, such as education and roads and stuff, is this really what we want to do? And is this really the solution to dealing with Russia? And I would argue we have had other good things that we've done with Russia, such as the Iran deal, a START treaty, which reduced nuclear weapons between the two countries. There are other avenues in dealing with Russia besides military buildup.
Now, I wonder if we turn our attention to the Obama and Pentagon decision to build a new generation of nuclear weapons and your organization's view of that very expensive decision. This is certainly going to be quite costly for the United States taxpayers over the next bunch of years.
Yeah, just a little history. During the Cold War, at one point, the world had some 70,000 nuclear warheads. Now we're down to about 16,000 nuclear warheads. 95% of those are held by Russia or the U.S. And we recently had a good treaty that we got together with Russia a number of years ago and ratified by the U.S. Senate called the New START Treaty. So that's going to bring down the U.S. to about 1,515 strategic warheads in the next couple of years. And then we have a few thousand that are in reserve and a few thousand that are in line to be dismantled in what we thought was going to be an effort to be moving towards zero. There was a very historic speech several years ago by President Obama in Prague, in which he talked about getting to a world free of nuclear weapons, one of the first sitting presidents to state this goal, and that we'd be moving towards that. But here we are. Our plans are now to spend $1 trillion over 30 years on nuclear weapon modernization. So here at a time, we're moving down to 1,500, and the president himself has already said, and his advisors have said, that we could probably cut that down another third, no problem, so we can easily go down to 1,000. And there's even other military experts who agree that we could actually go down to 300 nuclear weapons and still have a deterrent, if you believe in the deterrence policy. But at the same time, we're supposed to be moving to zero, but we're going to spend $1 trillion over 30 years, and it's something that we can't afford.
That was Paul Kavika-Martin, Political and Communications Director with the group Peace Action. Find more analysis of growing tensions between the U.S. and Russia by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.